Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour. And today is Monday, July 25th, 2022. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available thanks to the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice, absolutely free on the website at whyagain.org. If you go there and click on the Start Here link in the upper left-hand corner of the page, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. The book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of that book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using for almost 18 years to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Download it, print it off, copy it as often as you'd like, and use it over and over again, absolutely free. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you choose to tap on that, it will let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet, an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. You can also download a whole host of audio files of shows just like this one, where people have been stepped through the Reality Management Worksheet process. And if you choose to listen to those, they can serve as a powerful tutorial to help you get better, more efficient use of or results from the use of the worksheet process, and perhaps even give you some ideas about ways that you might apply it in your life that you hadn't even thought about. And people have called in to talk about doing a worksheet for a variety of emotions and a variety of situations, whether it's financial or relationship or depression or any life event that we might say, this is not going the way I want it to, and then generate a negative emotion for that situation, that would be a good use of the tool. So if you do that, which we hope people do soon and often, because it leads to improved quality of life for most of us, and because it also tends to spark comments, questions, answers, or testimonials. And if you have any of that to share with us, please give us a call at 563-999-3581 and press 1. Or you can email us, tjh@mindshifters-academy.org, or you can email Jeannie at jeannie@whyagain.org. And if you do that, we will address the comment, question, answer, or testimonial in the show. And as time allows, send you an email letting you know what day and time we address that issue and you can go back in the archives and listen to it. So, we've been working with Way of Mastery this year, and we're open for comments and questions about how it's landing for you. On Friday, I was beginning the review of Lesson 16, which is talking about the origin of these energies that we call egoic consciousness, the soul, the concept of separation, and all of these ideas, energies, mathematical concepts, you might consider them, all happening before anything physical in this universe. And please remember, if you have a comment or question, call 563-999-3581 and press 1. Even if I'm in the middle of reading something or in a monologue, I will either turn on your microphone almost instantaneously, or when I feel it's a good time to do so for the flow of the show. In Lesson 16, where we left off on Friday, was the idea that the thought of being separate from the Creator being able to be separate from itself, was the birth of a new energy. Because prior to that, the energy of creation was only extending, expanding, and creating. And as soon as the Creator decided, I think I'll play with the idea of being able to separate from myself, to be other than myself, at that first thought of separation, a different energy was born, a different flavor of the creative energy was born. That which has been pure joy, that which has been pure freedom, pure safety, now it changes form slightly. You could say that a drop of milk within the drop of milk seems to separate and to take on its own energy. And that's the energy we have called fear. Here is born not extension, which was the creative energy, but contraction. Or the dream of contraction, the experience of contraction, as fear emerges in awareness. Now the river begins to cascade very, very quickly. Out of fear, out of the first inception of the thought, quote, I am alone, I am separate from my Creator, close quotes. Yet, in reality, it is the Creator perceiving the Creator and creating the perception that the Creator is separate from itself. With that thought, an explosion occurs, very much like what your scientists have called the Big Bang. They do not know how close they are. They merely need to make the shift to seeing that the Big Bang occurred in consciousness itself, not out of pure matter. The Big Bang occurred in consciousness. In the Big Bang of consciousness, suddenly imagine that a drop of milk exploding in space, which comes into being with the thought of separation, and becoming an infinite array or number of points, like droplets of milk, like little droplets of consciousness, little sparks of divinity, little particles of light. To use yet another analogy from your realm of science, the wave of light has now become particles of light. Why and when? Who can say? only that one, only the creation itself, who is doing the birthing of itself, knows. And here's the rub. You're made of that stuff of creation. You are that one. You have a connection to that one mind. The text goes on and says, as these particles of light are now spread out through the infinite reaches of pure potentiality of spirit, which is light, which is the creation itself, each particle possesses the exact same potential. In fact, you could not find any difference between the points of light, any difference whatsoever, none. If you were to measure them, they would be the same size, although they have no size. If you measured their frequency or vibration, they would be all the same. Identical points of light that seem to have now taken existence in different points of space. That is, there is the sense that while they are all identical in quality and substance, there is a slight difference in the space that each one occupies. As though you took two identical pencils and put one on the left side of the table and one on the right. They are still made of the same substance, but now, in the vast continuum of space, that which is identical is occupying two points of space, each with the perfect freedom, mirroring the perfect freedom of the one creation itself. Infinite rays of light, now mirroring and reflecting the perfection of the freedom of pure potentiality, which is the light itself, the pure potentiality to create. And each one has within it the thought, the recognition, the perception, the dream of separation. Here, fear has been birthed, and with it, the thoughts, quote, I am alone. I'm not that point of light over there. I'm just myself, close quotes. And as the energy of fear continues, the contraction, the condensation, the dissension continues. Now what has burst forth simultaneously, and this is not yet requiring time, what has burst forth simultaneously is the multitude, the infinite multidimensionality, which is creation. Except that the physical universe has not yet been birthed. The physical universe requires the concept of time. For only in time does the physical universe exist. Here is where you find what has been called in your lineage the hierarchy of angelic beings, angelic worlds. They are points of light just like you. But not in the experience of time, nor in the condensation that you would call physical bodies. Not even the lower astral bodies. Still, this multidimensionality of creativity is a radiant dance with just a tinge of a sense of separation or otherness or fear. So, again, as we've talked about, this lesson, lesson 16, is like a koan, an extensive koan. How could it be that here's this movement from that which never moves? How could it be that all of these words we're talking about are pointing at something before the creation of any mind with a physical brain, of any body, of any size, any shape, any sense of space, up or down, left or right, any concept of time. Everything was all at once. Everywhere, everything, all at once. It's the concept that our quantum physics scientists are trying to get us to wrap our minds around. If you would go to YouTube and look for videos from the movie What the Bleep Do We Know and Down the Rabbit Hole, and I think if you search for, you know, Captain Quantum, you end up with snippets from that movie where they're trying to talk and show diagrams about what our quantum physics scientists are learning. And what they're learning is that everything is energy, and infinite potentiality exists all the time. Dr. Quantum, not Captain Quantum. And it seems to manifest into a solid state in interaction with human thought. And unless there's a human being there to observe it or think about it, infinite potentialities exist in every moment in what some would call the quantum soup. But you can look up Dr. Quantum and the Flatland, which is a five and a half minute video, or you can look up Dr. Quantum and the Double Slit Experiment, which is a little over 5 minutes. And it is just some visuals and some words to try to help you stretch your mind to what our science is revealing about the soup, the potentiality, the infinite expansion of space that we exist in, and how we are creating our sense of perception and our experience of that infinite expanse of space. So, this lesson is trying to get us to soften and breathe and live more in the question. Rainer Maria Rilke, the poet, the German-speaking poet, talks about that in his writings quite a bit. David White understands the essence of it. Krishnamurti talked almost exclusively about learning to live in direct observation as opposed to your thoughts and your beliefs. And this whole chapter so far, I view it as a way to soften whatever I've accumulated as thoughts and beliefs about my body as part of the physical universe, etc. Because everything, you know, for the first 5 or 6 pages that we've read here in lesson 16, you know, first 5 and a half pages, it's talking about concepts and experience and pure potentiality and spirit and the desire to see oneself as separate from itself and all of that happening before there was ever anything physical at all. And if you're like most of us, raised in a Western mind, your head is spinning by now. trying to wrap your mind around that. And that's okay. That's a good thing to do. As long as you don't take it too seriously, as long as you play with it, as long as you stay tuned in to how your body feels tight or tense, and then soften and breathe if it gets tight or tense. When it gets frustrated trying to wrap its conscious logical mind around these concepts. Again, these lessons have told us over and over again, do not let seriousness enter the mind. Be playful, dance, laugh, sing, allow, surrender, and watch what happens as you put your conscious logical mind on the side or keep it so busy that it gets burned out and frustrated. Watch what steps in to fill the space. Watch how the awakened heart opens and introduces you to other possibilities and other experience of yourself and others. The text then goes on in the next section is titled, The Creation of the Physical Universe. The text reads, in this multidimensionality, which is still pervaded and is the light of creation itself, the condensation continues. And here your scientists begin to tap into it, so you can see how many steps removed they are. But here, light begins to condense into the particle of matter. Again, the explosion occurs as the one basic atom, A-T-O-M, or adam, A-D-A-M, as it explodes in the Big Bang. And the multitude of bodies, of planetary bodies, including your central sun, of your tiny little universe, it's all birthed instantaneously. The physical universe of which you are a part as a human being is vast beyond comprehension. Yet, it is as a tiny speck of dust. There's another colon. The universe is vast beyond comprehension and as tiny as a speck of dust. It is as a tiny speck of light floating seemingly freely like a tiny drop of milk that seems to have separated itself from the body of milk. And it is unaware of the multidimensionality of radiant capital L light and capital S spirit and the creation in which it floats, out of which it has been given its very existence. You are, therefore, not outside of spirit. You are held lovingly. Your whole physical dimension is held lovingly in the center of spirit. Now, you know, it's time to just step back and say, wait a minute. I'm a psychologist. I have a practice where I have first responders, policemen and firefighters and EMTs, and they're constantly going on calls where people have either experienced an accidental trauma or people have been the victims of intentional trauma perpetrated by other human beings. And what is this? We're held lovingly in spirit. That the entire universe is held lovingly. And yet, traumas happen all the time. People are abusive in relationships. People are physically, sexually, verbally, emotionally abusive. People abuse drugs and alcohol. People have, you know, abandonment issues. People, it goes on and on. How can we say you and your entire physical dimension are held lovingly in the center of spirit? Well, here's the issue. The absolute truth of it is that life just keeps going on. That life, nature, the flow of life and creation is extension, expansion, and creation. And one of the aspects of that at the pure spirit level, according to this book, was the thought of creating the idea of separation. And so it's like a layer on top of or alongside of this expansive flow of creation. And so when humans come into being and they're birthed only because of this egoic consciousness, which was birthed from the thought of separation or the idea of trying to create an experience of separation, and humans come on the scene and they've got greed and they've got resentments and they've got shoulds and they've got religions and they've got ideologies and they've got nationalities, they create another layer or level of experience which is completely separate from the movement of creation itself. The movement of creation is just there. Go on out. It's the summertime. Go on out in the winter when everything is dormant and frozen and covered in snow and ice. Go on out again in the springtime. You'll see this flow of the creative energy. And you can watch, if you get close enough to nature, you can watch all of these creatures moving with that flow. Humans have created the belief that they are separate from nature, just as the soul created the belief that it could be separate from the creator. And so we create an experience of rage and bitterness and trauma and violence. And yet all of that is happening within the context that everything in this universe is being held lovingly in the center of spirit, pure potentiality, pure creation, pure intelligence. The text goes on and says, as this condensation continues, what you have been told to call, quote, life, close quote, begins. Conditions are set up, emerging from what? From pure chance? Hardly. It emerges out of the pure potentiality, the power, perfect intelligence to create. Although now that creativity is expressing itself more and more out of the energy of creation shifted to fear rather than the energy of pure joy. Rather than the energy of extension, now it's being expressing itself more out of the energy of contraction and separateness and fear and all of its stepchildren, anger and resentment and hurt and jealousy and greed. It's just like taking the note of a flute and muffling it slightly. It's the same energy of creation that has been twisted, muffled, bent to express so that it has a different quality. Yet it is still pure energy. For what can fear be but energy? Just as love is energy, compassion is energy, sadness is energy, and anger is energy. So please, try to see this. Fear is just an energy and nothing more. In itself, it is perfectly neutral because all events are neutral. And fear, being merely a dance or play of energy itself, must be an entirely neutral event. That is, until something arises, like a human mind, an egoic consciousness, to perceive and experience it differently. And what is that? That is the birth of egoic consciousness. And now, fear has taken its final form. There can be no further condensation of the energy that has become fear, for egoic consciousness is fear-full consciousness. It is full of fear. It is a consciousness created of the energy of contraction that here we're calling fear. The ego is fear. Yet it is made of pure power, pure potentiality, and unlimited creativity. Rest assured, you have all had the experience of knowing just how ceaselessly creative the egoic mind can be. For without ceasing, it knows how to immediately look upon another brother or sister or event or anything, and just that fast, in the twinkling of an eye, in the space that does not even require a thought, egoic consciousness can change its values, can change its perceptions to create what it wants to create, something other than the pure potentiality and the pure extension of the creative force. What it wants to create is that which continues its existence. And since the egoic consciousness was born out of the contraction, the thought of being separate, and the energy we're calling fear, the egoic consciousness will continue to generate rationalizations for the need for fear. Now, the example it's given here is in the physical universe when a cell becomes cancerous and decides to run amok and act as though it were not dependent. Not dependent on the laws of the body. Not dependent on anything to keep the body healthy. It begins to do what? It creates more and more cells just like itself. Cancer is a misperception run amok at the level of the body that is thinking for itself, creating in its own image rather than extending the image of the Creator and living out of harmony with the one mind that creates in radiant joy for no other reason than to extend the good, the holy, and the beautiful. And people have all kinds of discussions about, well, how could God do this, and how could, and it isn't this anthropomorphized God creature up in the clouds that's just like us, only bigger and more powerful. That's our fantasy. What the creation is this powerful energy always extending. What the creation has generated is a part of itself looking back at itself, playing with the extension of this energy of contraction. And yet it says creation does not create limitation, and therefore it does not withdraw creativity from the power of the ego. Rather, because creation is love, all power and under heaven and earth is available and can be tapped into by the egoic consciousness. So this energy of creation is available to be extended even in contraction, to create the experience of contraction, the experience of fear, the experience of danger. So what is egoic consciousness? You all know what it feels like to be absolutely certain that you are separate and alone, that you must rely on your own thinking process, and that no one beyond, not just the boundary of your body and skin, but no one beyond your unique, contracted sense of I has any connection to you whatsoever. And you create the belief that no one cares. And then you lament, quote, I am alone. I am separate. how on earth am I going to make it? I've got to figure this out my own way. I've got to figure out how this world works. I just have to make it happen for myself. Close quotes. And now fear has taken its final form. And now there is a complete forgetting of the creation, of the one mind, of spirit, even of your soul. The body represents a level of vibration. It is still quite intelligent, still very intelligent, yet it is like a matrix of energy, the very thought of condensation into human form, out of which forms keep getting created and keep getting created and keep getting created and keep getting created. That's the matrix of energy we're calling egoic consciousness. You have done that for yourself an infinite number of times. The body is a representation of the ego. For notice that as you sit in your chair, you're quite certain that you're not the same as the wall across the room from you. As you sit where you are in your chair, your consciousness, your awareness tells you that you are the listener to this work, not the speaker of it. You are the observer, not the author. And you think, well, not me. I couldn't do that if I wanted to. Certainly, it makes Yeshua very special, for I'm just a blob of dust. I'm this separate mind-body sitting in my chair. I'm just listening to these words that vibrate a certain meaning and create certain pictures and understandings in my mind. But these things are being placed within me. I'm not that one. I'm not smart enough to conceive this, understand this, create this. That is egoic consciousness. And it says, I'm not that one. I am not like the rest of creation. I am not God. I am not pure spirit. I am not pure soul. I'm this blob of stuff that sits here in this chair. The text says, and you know what? You're absolutely right. You are that blob that sits in that chair. And you are that and so much more. The egoic mind is that which creates the separated perception that it is only one tiny thin slice of the pie. It creates a delusion, a distortion. It's a distortion in consciousness itself, like a little blip on a radar screen that tells the one watching the screen that there is something out there. The egoic mind says, quote, I am separate. I am alone. I cannot think with the mind of God. I cannot experience unity consciousness. I cannot be as Yeshua is. No, not me. I'm too small, too weak. Oh, I just don't have it together yet. Maybe someday. And yet, all the while egoic consciousness is saying those things, you are that one. And it is by the power of that one that you have the potential to think the thought that I could never be like Yeshua. I'm too small, too fragile, too weak, and too stupid. You're using the power of creation to create the experience of being small, fragile, weak, and stupid. You're using the very power of creation to create a thought like, oh, well, Christ consciousness may be there for somebody else, but not for me. And the whole while, that very thought that you're using to create the thought of being small and weak and stupid is the power of the one being used by you. For that power is the energy of life. That power is pure being. That power is the actual world. That power is the only thing that exists, period. By the power of that one, you have dreamt the thought of being a separate self. By the power of the one mind, by the power of creation itself, when you decide to, you will awaken from the thought of egoic consciousness. It's all the same energy. It's the energy of creation. It's the energy of the one mind. The text goes on and asks, now, why is all of this important? Beloved friends, the way of transformation requires that there be that which exists in form. You exist in form. You are sitting in a chair. You know the space and volume of body. You know the particular thoughts that you identify as your own. You have a history to that body-mind that emerged from sexual desire between two beings called parents who got together. And a little thing wiggled its way up to another little thing, and there was this burst of light and a pure spark of pure soul made a decision from intentionality to become fixated or identified with and as a physical form. So, having a good time on a Saturday night is the source of your being as a bodily being. And if you were lucky, both parents consciously desired to use the body as a communication device for teaching only love. And they gave one unto another. And then they accepted that little spark of light that begins yet the birthing of another body. And they clearly invited another soul to come and abide with them as a teacher and a friend, as a brother, or a sister. Unfortunately, that is yet rare upon your planet. That is the matrix into which you have descended, time and again, as you have come to teach yourself that you are just a separate, lonely, failing, weak individual. At the death of the body, you have found yourself as a soul and been frightened by the radiance of your own light. Because that light is not quite the same as your interpretation that you had learned of yourself. Fear causes condensation, contraction, falling, if you will. And what you fall into is a matrix of energy that best resonates with your own perception and your belief about yourself. Belief is not just thought. It is a quality of vibration. And you fall yet again into the field of energy, into a dream, into a physical universe, into a time frame, into a family structure that resonates and vibrates with how you have learned to perceive yourself. All the while, you are yet that one, radiant, perfectly free, and using the power, the very power of creation, to create and believe in a dream of smallness, weakness, separation, and loneliness. Right now, as you read these words, as you hear these words spoken, that is what you are doing. You are choosing how you will think of yourself. And what you think of yourself is reflected in the world that you see, in the experiences that are manifest within your own particular universe of consciousness. If you knew that you were the unlimited one, you would never fear the creation of the golden coins ever again. You would never believe that you must live in lack. but you are still, for the most part, clinging to the belief that you are that small little thought of separation called the egoic mind. You're clinging to the idea that you must still struggle to find the Creator, not recognizing that it is the very power of the Creator's presence from which you create the perception you hold of yourself. So it's grinding away at this concept. It's trying to get us to understand over and over and over again that we are creating our experience of life. From the very first lesson, page 5, it says, here, the first step in awakening is to allow into your mind this axiom of truth. Nothing that I experience is caused by anything outside of me. I experience only the effects of my own choice. Here in lesson 16, it's trying to get us to understand from an entirely different perspective how far back that choice of perception goes. It goes back to before there was anything physical, before there was even a separate soul, that you are a spark of the divine mind, and the only reason you experience yourself as separate at all is because as a part of the divine mind, you made the choice to see if you could dream the dream of separation. So you can continue to believe what's been programmed into you from your family and your culture. Anything about being small, weak, limited, stupid, you can continue to believe that. And as you do, you continue to create your experience of life. You can also start looking into the origins of your errors in thought, as the way A Course in Miracles would ask us to, with the understanding that when we look at and go back to see the original point of error in thought, that's enough to dismantle all of the negative effects of that error in thought. We are still free to choose. This whole book is about choose, choose again, choose, 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 choosing, choice. If you knew that you were part of the one mind, you would never fear creating golden coins again. You'd never believe you have to live in lack. But as you're hearing this, you're still, for the most part, clinging to the belief that you are that small little thought of separation that here we're calling the egoic mind. You're still struggling to find God or to find the source of creation or to find yourself or to find power. You're not realizing that it is the very power of creation and the presence of the Creator within you from which you create the perception of being small and weak and stupid and lacking. So there you are, sitting in your chair, and you are that one. You are in form. That is, you have created a perception of yourself that includes the experience of being a body-mind. And this body-mind is separate from all other bodies. It's separate from that rock. Obviously, you can look out your window and you can tell where your body ends and these other things begin. It's at a different spatial point than every other object. That is what this world is. This universe is an attempt to create a reflection that convinces you that your first fearful thought of separation is the truth of who you are. You are using or have unwittingly been using your physical universe to constantly reflect to you what must be the truth in terms of your thinking, that you are separate from all of creation. This world is nothing but the reflection of that thought. And yet, even here, that one pervades all things. And the realization of yourself as that one is closer to you than your own breath. It is simply a decision away. This book, this chapter, is calling us over and over again to choose a different form of perception, to wake up to the fact that it is us in each moment using the power of creation to create our experience of life. And I have in my room this book, you know, Messages of Life from Death Row. Here's an example of somebody, Roger McGowan, in some of the most restrictive and abusive conditions we have on this continent, and he's chosen, he's awakened to the fact that he can choose how to create his perception of life moment to moment. I doubt that he's ever tapped into the Way of Mastery, but this isn't unique to the Way of Mastery. This is deep spiritual teaching that comes from a wide variety of sources through the eons, through the thousands of years that we've had human consciousness on this planet. So the call is to choose. The call is to awaken. The call is to live in the question and to question and observe what happens when I choose fearful thoughts, what's happening in my body, what happens when I choose loving thoughts, peaceful thoughts, joyful thoughts. What happens when I choose jealous thoughts, angry thoughts? How closely is my physical body's sensations tied to the thoughts that I pour my mind energy into? And observe and play with it and awaken more and more to the realization that in each new present moment, whether your house is messy or spotless, whether your health is optimal and strong or suboptimal and weak and pained, you can choose. You are choosing in each moment. The focus of your conscious awareness, and that is what creates your experience of life. You can look in the mirror one day and view yourself as ugly and have an experience of tension and contraction and bad feelings and negative emotions. And you can, in that same day or the next day, look at yourself in the mirror and think, I'm not doing too bad. I'm beautiful. And you will instantaneously create a different experience. It's all an inside job. And what appears to be this world outside of us, this external world, is, as what the Way of Mastery would say at one point, it's a consensus reality. We get other people to agree with us that life is bad or hard or violent or greedy, and then we have that experience. So, what is it that we're going to choose to create for ourselves? Are we going to choose to create more of those things that we say we really don't want? Or are we going to wake up to what we are doing with our conscious logical mind, our energy, and how that literally creates our experience in the moment? Are we going to practice playing in this life, choosing to see ourselves as being here, to play with the energy of creation? Are we going to awaken to the fact that each and every one of us has a dominion over your mind energy, the focus that you create for this creative force which is always on, and then take more and more responsibility day in and day out for where you're pointing that energy? Are you pointing that creative energy towards joy, contentment, allowance, surrender, peace, bliss? Or are you pointing it at bitterness, resentment, shoulds, shouldn'ts, have-tos? That's what we're being called to awaken to. And if we're willing to awaken to that, the promise is we will at least have something dramatically different than what we already have. It may not be exactly what we say we want it to be from the conscious logical perspective, and yet it will be different. And in that doing, in that shifting of focus, and that creating of a different experience for ourselves, we demonstrate to ourselves the benefits of taking 100% responsibility for whatever we're creating, internally, mentally, emotionally, and yes, even physically. Question, observe, allow, surrender, question and observe. It is up to us, and we have been given this creative capacity, and so waking up to the fact that that's the way it is gives us more potential for creating consciously, creating in a pleasant way, creating in a way that we find preferable to the thoughts of smallness, powerlessness, limitedness, limitation and lack. So I trust that you're all feeling free to press one at any time. That open invitation is still there. Even when we're reading, even when there's a monologue going, please feel free to call us at 563-999-3581. And I'll just take a moment to remind us all that we come from love. We're made of this stuff we call love. We actually are love, this energy of creation expressing in form, and everything else is false. Welcome, Jeannie Rice.
Thank you, Dr. Tam. Appreciate it.
Your voice is sounding more normal every time we talk.
I know. It's, I still have a little cough every now and then, but I'd say 99% there. We've actually got the baby today, and I'm able to keep up with her, so that's a plus.
Yeah. Wonderful. We'll have a lovely show.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Tim. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mind Shifters Radio. And today is Monday. What date is it? July the 25th. Goodness, it'll be Christmas before we know it. And our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And press 1, and that puts you into queue to talk to us. We'd love to hear your comments and questions because that makes this your show. And Michael will dial in here in just a second. I'll invite you to go to our website, whyagain, whyagain.org. And you can click on either schedules or you can scroll down to events, either one, and you will find several things there. the Global Book Club, which Michael participates in on the second and fourth. She meets several times during the week, but those are the only times that Michael participates. But you can join in with her at any time. The link to the Global Book Club is on the website there. There's also the Mind Shifters and Still Point Breathing monthly membership. We do that the second Saturday of every month, followed by the next Tuesday, a follow-up support meeting. And we've been doing that for, 9 or 10 months now. And small group that's there every week. And it's a powerful group, even though it is small. And then also under schedule, you'll be able to find the codependence to interdependence communication self-study. And there's a three-hour why workshop that Michael did, and that's there for free for you to watch. So lots of things out there that we're doing a few changes. And so just watch out for all that and let us know if you find something that doesn't work. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, dear heart, and welcome, everybody. Delighted and honored that you're here once again to join us. My voice is feeling like it's almost back to normal. Got another few good hours in the garden this morning. Our combo spins are almost complete and wood chopped and wood chips and layers of leaves and brown grass and all kinds of good stuff. So we be heading forward. I came across a quote last night that I had not heard from Kierkegaard, and it's so insightful because almost nobody has a clue about this idea that Yeshua has of forgiveness, that it's about collapsing perception based in something desired, and that desire, that goal, not being accessed leaves one filling the mind with traumatic events or traumatic experiences that have been unresolved. And then each time the mind does that, there's an opportunity to forgive, to remove that content from the mind. But I'd never heard this one before, and it's so insightful. Kierkegaard, it's a philosopher, says the most painful state of being is remembering the future. And to recognize that if there is a goal being held, something from the past is attempting to cause the mind to generate a perception that holds that future available, but an impossible future, then winds up in this trauma that, of course, is totally avoidable if one understands first century Aramaic forgiveness. For trying to remember something wonderful that was desired, but somehow or other crashed, somehow or other not available, is showing one that which is impossible because of circumstances. Painful state of being is remembering the future, particularly one you'll never have. Very powerful, very insightful. And it really explains, you know, kind of in a backhanded way, when you understand what first century Aramaic forgiveness is, the reason why you would cancel a goal, which is the core of first century Aramaic forgiveness. Why would you cancel a perfectly good and a perfectly wonderful goal? Because if you hold a goal where there is no hope, you know, that future that you'll never have, where you hold a goal, and I know that I've worked with people, this has been a particularly traumatic place for them in relationships when they had great hopes and dreams, a great future laid out, say, for instance, for a relationship. And then the relationship crashes, and people suffer horrendously, terribly, because there's unresolved pain in their minds and their goal to have that future causes the mind to utilize that unresolved, to imagine all the things that will never happen that would have been so wonderful, and to recognize that there's a way to short-circuit that sort of fantasy in the mind is just so profoundly powerful. To recognize that when one loads a goal in their mind, that seems to the mind to be an impossible goal, and the file in the mind that holds pain around impossible things fills perception with that pain. And that it's if understood, if the first century Aramaic forgiveness process is understood, you know, that future that you can't have is only painful because there's pain in your mind. And when you load that goal, it calls that pain into activity, trying to fantasize that which you wish you could have had, but never will. And instead of being this, you know, what he calls is such a painful or traumatic place, he labels it the most painful state of being, remaining the future, particularly the one you'll never have, because the mind is trying to imagine or trying to create a state of knowing where that possibility exists. At the same time, pulls in the pain for the unresolved pain for all the times when something that was desired wasn't there. And the beauty of the first century Aramaic forgiveness process is that it allows one to collapse that perception based in pain, come back into direct relationship with that pain, and hold at the moment where that occurs to the presence of active love. And one holds to the presence of active love, and the mind serves up its unresolved hidden pain, the unresolved hidden pain dissolves, and one is freed of it. So powerful, so profound. Kierkegaard, I guess, did not understand or have the brain cells for first century Aramaic forgiveness, or else I suspect that at the same time as he had offered this most painful state of being, he'd have said, and one of the most profoundly possible states of healing is to apply forgiveness in that circumstance. So understanding first century Aramaic forgiveness is a very, very powerful piece of understanding, a very, very powerful tool to have. And if you are not engaging with that forgiveness process as yet, we invite you to go to our website. And our website is whyagain.org. In the upper left-hand corner, there's a Start Here button. Click the Start Here button, and that will walk you all the way through this first century Aramaic process of forgiveness, the how-to of it. You can do the worksheet process right there on the website live. You can download the worksheet and print it on your own printer at home and do the worksheet, you know, longhand. Or you can go to your app store on your phone, type in the words Heartland, H-E-A-R-T-L-A-N-D, Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. You'll be looking at the world's only forgiveness app, and you'll be able to engage in first century Aramaic forgiveness right there on your phone. Powerful way of collapsing unconscious, collapsing perception into the unconscious pain that sources that pain perception, and giving the opportunity to walk through, work through, and be finished with that particular pain. So everybody should take the tools, put it to work. Watch what happens. It's amazing to see the transformation, the way that people, over time, using that tool, if one will use it regularly, there's nothing to believe about it, but over time, if you apply that first century Aramaic forgiveness principle, what happens is the load of unresolved pain gets lighter and lighter and lighter until one is free of it. And perception becomes so much cleaner and so much clearer because there's not all that projection from the past. Because trying to remember a wonderful future you're never going to have, it's nothing other than a projection of a past where something was missing and one generated pain as a result of that or lived out of the pain of their own generations. You know, those painful moments are passed on to us. And if we only understood that they're the opportunity to remove pain from the mind and live literally pain-free, whether you've got everything you want or whether you've got nothing that you want. There's no reason whatsoever to be in pain because you're missing something that you would like to have. Other than you've got unresolved pain, your mind fills that space with pain. So it's such a profoundly powerful way to lift the burdens of errant perception and projection of past generational pain or past self-created pain. The removal of that and the ability to sit in a space where one is neutral, in that neutral space, find a connectedness with one's own state of true being. And when one finds a state of connectedness with one's own true being, what they found is active present love, because that's the stuff we're made of. So delighted you're here with us today. And Ms. Jeannie, do we have anybody in the phone queue with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room?
It is all quiet. So there's several people on the switchboard. Press 1 if you have a question.
Is Ms. Susan with us today?
She is not.
Oh, okay. Because I had a suggestion for her and some of the things she's working on. So if she happens to come on, let's plug her in and say hello.
Okay. So Michael Teddy just put his hand up. 770, you're on the air.
Oh, cool. Awesome. Let's say hello. How are you, Michael?
Good, Michael. How are you all doing?
Fabulous. We're rocking. Doing much better.
Wonderful.
Definitely on the upside.
It's sounding good on this end, so that's great. Great to hear.
Yeah.
This year.
Glad to be able to say it.
Yes, I'm sure.
Glad to be able to say it. Yesterday I got about, I couldn't have done it the week before, but yesterday I got about 4 good hours in the garden building compost bins and then went out and did the rest of chopping of tree limbs and such to give us a good foundation of wood chips along with leaves and grass and just getting those spaces ready to grow more soil.
Very nice.
It is.
Very nice. And wonderful growing.
It is. So what's happening? Yes.
That's what we need.
For sure. So what's on your mind today? How do you be? What's exciting in your world?
Well, lots of things. But I wanted to know if we could continue with last week. You were discussing the difference between dissociation and suppression. I wonder if we can pick up, maybe do a quick review on that. I did a little research over the weekend, and I do remember as I looked into it a little bit further, you mentioning it in that 3-hour training that you did in June, early June, I think it was.
Right.
What amazed me is dissociation is, I believe, from a psychology standpoint, it's in the DSM manual. It's considered an identity disorder. There's actually several different types. And I don't know how deep, I know that's one thought, and I'd like to understand how that thought relates to how you explain it and where you go with that versus suppression, please.
Right. Well, and we did bring in another word into that equation that's a similar but different use of the word disassociation. So the word that I use in the Why Is This Happening to Me Again workshop, the whole concept there is dissociation as opposed to disassociation, which did come into the conversation. And disassociation is a state where one is in a traumatic event and disconnects from their own awareness, their own minds and bodies. And oftentimes someone in that disassociated state will experience themselves. For instance, they often talk about someone who goes through what they call a near-death experience, which is really a near-life experience, and how there they are, and they are able to accurately describe exactly what the doctor did while they were clinically dead, and what people, when they come back, when clinical death is overcome and they come back to their bodies and are back, you know, what would be called alive, that they describe having been up in the corner of the room watching the doctor work on them. They've disassociated from their bodies totally. This often happens to people in, you know, children in traumatic events that it's too painful to handle, so they just cut off all sensation, all awareness, and step away from their own bodies. So that would be a state of disassociation, different from dissociation as we're using it. And yeah, there are many different ways and definitions of using that word dissociation, but specifically with this work, I tie it in with the result of denial. So, and we use a specific form of denial in this work, or a specific definition for the word denial, where the culture would think generally of denial as, well, I pretend or I say to myself, well, that never happened. You know, some terrible event happened and people deny that it occurred. Or, you know, the alcoholic says, well, no, it's everybody else's fault that I'm drinking. They're in denial about their drinking, what have you. But more specifically in this work, the definition of denial, as we're using the word, is that when I think or speak, pretend that something outside of me is a cause of what's moving inside of me. So there may be, say, something that happened to me in childhood that was very painful. I may have disassociated when that happened. I left my body. I didn't let myself experience it. And now, you know, 20, 30, 40, 50 years later, an event happens that triggers that memory into activity. Now, the reason the memory is triggered into activity is because it's there. It couldn't be triggered into activity if it weren't there. So obviously there is a cause within the person experiencing that memory that has nothing to do with what's going on in the world. But the person in denial will think or speak as though, let's say that that event when it happened, let's say it involved a lot of rage. So here somebody is 50 years later, and they fly into a fit of rage. That old memory is triggered. And their conversation with the person that's in the room with them is, you made me so angry. You enraged me. So when I say to you, you caused rage in me, I'm in denial. That's the first step in it. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yes, it does. And thank you. You read my mind, basically, in relating the difference between dissociation and disassociation. So I really appreciate that.
Right. Okay. And then, so now that I'm in denial about what's moving in me, that it was something that happened to me when I was five that I didn't want to experience and I disassociated from my own body at five, now 50 years later, you do a behavior that resonates or triggers that into activity, and the mind of the body, you know, and we call it a mind, and strictly speaking, that's a poor use or choice of words to call what moves in us from memory, mind in operation, because all it is information cycling. You know, calling that a mind would be, you know, like saying your computer has a mind. Now we say the computer has a brain, but to say the computer has a mind just because content that's in it is triggered into activity would be kind of silly. And it really is the same silliness in us as humans when we say that, you know, this is my mind and I am thinking, because the truth is there's no thinking involved. It's just a pure process of resonance. You do the behavior that triggers what I've dissociated from, and because of resonance, that dissociated pain comes into activity. It's resonated into activity, and now I'm re-experiencing that pain as though it's real today. You know, the mind can't tell the difference between a real and an imagined or a pain that's triggered into activity. So now something has been hidden in me, was resonated into activity to you by you, but it wasn't caused by you. And the cause was the fact that that pain was there in the first place for whatever reason, in this case, the five-year-old's experience. But when I say you made me angry, you enraged me, what I just did is I gave my mind instructions. You know, the basic nature, if you remember from the Why Is This Happening to Begin workshop, is the basic nature is what we call the mind is it's an evidential device. It gives us evidence that we ask for. And when I say you enraged me, in essence, what I'm saying to my mind, kind of a long form set of instructions I'm giving to my mind, what I'm saying is, mind, I have some rage in there, but I've decided I don't want to be responsible for it. So I don't want you showing me that this rage is mine. I want no evidence that relates to me having any association with this rage at all. I want you to build me a perception that shows me that Michael's responsible for my rage. The mind being the obedient servant, or again, what we call the mind being the obedient servant, takes that old rage. And because of the instruction set I've given it, or the implied instruction set when I said you made me angry, is my mind now takes data based in my experience of rage and data about you and melds them, massages them into a construct, a picture, a reality where my mind shows you as the cause of my rage. Now, in order to live that lie and believe it, and, you know, you just take a look around and interview people who are in denial all the time. You made me mad. You made me sad. Oh, that political thing really upset me. Oh, she really disturbed me. Oh, he terrified me, blah, blah, blah. You listen to people in the conversation, and they believe the lies their mind's telling them that somebody outside of them is the cause of what's moving inside of them, which is totally and completely ludicrous and impossible. That you could cause something to happen in me that isn't already in me. Yes, you can sure trigger it into activity, but you couldn't possibly cause it. But my mind hallucinates construct in which you become totally and completely responsible because I've dissociated from my own pain. And so I take that pain content that you triggered into activity, and I use it to build my brain's picture of you. And now you show up in my mind with my pain attached, and I'm sure it must be your problem. I'm right. You enraged me. And I've totally dissociated from the real cause of my rage, which means I can never heal my rage. And if I blame you, and then tomorrow I blame Bill, and the next day I blame Harry and Mary and Hortense, I build and build and build the intensity of that pain, and I project it into my brain's image of more and more and more people. And so I come to the point where, in fact, way back, there was a magazine. I was writing my book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? There was a magazine called, let's see, what was the name of it? Back, it was back in Fort Lauderdale. This goes back 35, 38 years ago. It was a relationship magazine, and they asked if I'd do an article on relationships. And I'm a slow writer. When I write very intensely, and I write, and I rewrite, and I rewrite, and I'm sitting at the kitchen table, and I can see myself so clearly sitting there, and I'm working on this article, and the article starts out is with, why is this happening to me again? Why are all people the same? And so people come to the point where they start to believe that everybody's the same, because the dissociated content in their own minds, they've projected into so many people that it's all everybody else's fault. And they're the ones who are like that, when the truth is, the reality my mind is projecting into my brain's image of them is really telling me about the content of my own mind. And the power of breaking down the denial process, and instead of projecting, instead of massaging my own content, dissociating from the real cause of it and massaging it into a picture of you that makes it look like you're the problem, I could be collapsing that picture. And since you triggered my pain into activity with what you said, the truth is you've given me the opportunity to own and forgive, remove my pain and get rid of it rather than carry it around in my unconscious. And the disadvantage of carrying unresolved pain around in your own unconscious is it creates diseases, because it's stored literally in the cellular structure. Literally, it shows up in the cell as chemistry. And if it is of a dis-ease quality, then that dis-ease quality of mind energy literally distorts the cell. And my offering is it is the cause of every so-called physical disease that there is. So instead of that cycle of you do a behavior, resonates my pain, I deny, you cause my pain, I hallucinate, I generate a construct that shows me you're the cause of my pain, and dissociating from the real cause, I now cannot get rid of my disease, because I can't see that it's mine. I can't see that I've got anything to do with it. But of course, when some wise guy like me comes along and says, oh, by the way, have you noticed you've been through that particular painful reality 87 different times with 42 different people? Did it ever occur to you that maybe, since you've been through it so many times, seemingly with so many different people, that maybe you're involved, maybe it's yours and it's not theirs? And that's a real break open moment for people if they're willing to step into truth. Otherwise, they live the life stuck in this cycle of deny, dissociate, project, deny, and everybody else becomes the enemy. And what happens, people then tend to isolate themselves from others. And have you ever noticed, if you've ever studied the lives of people who live as a recluse, they get a little wacky, because the only person to project it on is the person in the mirror that they fantasize that they are. So now they start to get a little wacky with themselves. And if first century Aramaic forgiveness steps into that void, then one understanding that goals drive this process of generating perception, and if perception has pain of any sort in it, it's because there's pain stored in the mind, that when the apply forgiveness, when they cancel the goal that drives that perception collapses, and it collapses in on itself. You know, if you remember on 9/11, the towers, the Twin Towers, collapsed in on their own footprint. Well, that's kind of a model for me of the way perception works. When I touch the mainspring of perception, my goal, and I remove it, the perception, just like the tower, collapses in on its own footprint, which means it gives me access directly to the underlying hidden pain that I've dissociated from. And by accessing it and bringing it forward in the presence of active love, our diseases, our pain dissipates and disappears, and we're freed of it. That's what Yeshua figured out 2,000 years ago. And the Greeks buried it in the idea that forgiveness is pardoning. I'm going to let you off the hook for what's happening inside of me. Does that fit and make sense of your first worksheet you did recently?
Yes, greatly. So is it a correct understanding that the way to reverse dissociation is the reality worksheet?
Correct. Yeah, the way to undo denial is to own something. But before owning it, what you want to do is be able to access the underlying pain and removing it. You know, the word forgiveness is removal. More accurately, from first century Aramaic, the word forgiveness would be represented by the word removal rather than let somebody off the hook. And what I do in order to engage in forgiveness, and, you know, it literally took me, I mean, I started 43 years ago when I was introduced to the idea of what forgiveness was in Aramaic to teach this canceling of goals. When I first ran across the idea, you know, I was doing workshops and teaching, and every once in a while it didn't strike me as particularly meaningful, the idea of forgiveness, when I first started to work with it. I was teaching other materials along these lines, and I would once in a while mention this idea, and over time I had several people come to me and said, you know, I've been working with that canceling of goals that you shared in that workshop last week or last month, and man, that's changing my life. That's so powerful. And after I had, I don't know, maybe four or five people come to me saying that, I went back and started to really look at it and start working, and that's when I started to really discover what forgiveness was, a la Yeshua from 2,000 years ago. But to be able to explain what I just explained in the last 15 minutes literally took me 35 years, because there's so much baggage around forgiveness. If you come out of our Greek culture, you made me mad. Oh, yes, I'll forgive you. Yes, I forgave them. Oh, I'm going to forgive them. Oh, yes, I'll forgive myself. That's all hogwash. Vladimir Lenin was brilliant. You know, he's probably responsible for more deaths than any human being on planet Earth in history. And he said, if you want to destroy a culture, change the meaning of its words. Yeshua created a culture of forgiveness. The Greeks destroyed it. They changed the meaning of one word. The tool with which people unloaded their generational and self-created pain and trauma was removed from the minds of people following Yeshua. Because they were taught that forgiveness was about letting somebody else or themselves off the hook for their pain. And so once I really started to understand it, and again, to fully understand it took me, and maybe I still don't even fully understand it, but the level of understanding I am now, it took me about 35 years before I could explain what I just explained to you about how perception is formed, how to collapse perception and what it is that drives perception, and the benefit of being able to drop into the underlying dynamic that is beneath all pained perception. Wherever there is pained perception, there is dissociation. And so we want to end that dissociation and come back into, you know, whenever people are in pain, they're in relationship with their pain. The problem with being in relationship with your pain when you're in denial is that your relationship with your pain is indirect. In other words, yeah, oh, I am hurting terribly. Look what Bill did to me. So through their brain's image of Bill, they're experiencing their pain, but of course it's all Bill's fault. It's their pain moving. I mean, sooner or later you got to go, yeah, it's my physiology, it's my psyche that's in pain, it's my mind that's in pain, but it's an indirect relationship with pain. And when you have an indirect relationship with pain, you can't change it, you can't fix it. When you cancel the goal and perception collapses in to its own root, you come back into direct relationship with your pain. Any form of hostility or fear that you come into direct relationship with, when love is present in you, and you'll notice the step before you cancel the goal in the worksheet, you tap into and you bring love conscious, active, and present. So any dissociated pain that you come back into direct relationship with, when love is present, dissolves. It dissipates. It's removed. And that's Yeshua's first century Aramaic forgiveness. The exact opposite of what our culture teaches about forgiveness.
It is amazing. And this is why it's been, I'm guessing this is one reason why it's been so confusing to me over the years, as many institutions teach, we must forgive, but you don't have to forget.
Yep, exactly.
And I could never quite get my mind around that. And I think that is just another layer of confusion, possibly, would you say?
Yes. Yeah, whenever we're not in truth, when somebody tells a story that's not truth, what happens is the mind, living in blocks of truth, builds all kinds of stressors into itself. And whenever something comes along that ties into that dynamic, whatever it is, there's going to be pain. And there's going to be confusion. You know, the way the mind operates, when you realize that thoughts are electrical in nature, perception is electrical in nature, energetic. You know, I use the example, and I don't think I used it in that Y workshop that you've seen, but I use the example of, you'll notice when I did that workshop, I'm using a whiteboard. Let's imagine I've got this nice big whiteboard, and I have three lights. I have a red light, a blue light, and a green light. And I shine those three lights on the board. Now, we look at it, and if our mind's working what the world would call properly, when we look at the red light, we see red. When we look at the blue light, we see blue. We look at the green light, we see green. Some people are colorblind. You know, the truth is there's no such thing as red, blue, or green. Red, blue, or green are interpretations that most minds give to particular frequencies. Some people's brains interpret those frequencies differently, so we say they're colorblind. But I've got clarity on red, I've got clarity on blue, I've got clarity on green. Now, if I converge those three lights on the same spot, I will no longer have clarity on red, blue, or green. I'll have a mix. You know, literally, the frequencies of light that we call red and blue and green, when you shine them on one spot, those frequencies are additive and subtractive with each other. You know, if let's say I'm sitting watching television and somebody drives into my driveway with a poorly tuned car, that poorly tuned car is sending out frequency patterns that match the television station that I'm watching. And those frequency patterns are superimposed on the picture on the screen and the sound. And all of a sudden, I see interference on the screen and I hear this crackling noise. Those frequencies are added to what I'm watching on the television set. And now the television picture gets all confused and I can hardly hear because of the noise, the interference patterns. It's because of the additive and subtractive nature of frequencies. Light is the same. Thought is the same. So if my mind holds a lie, you made me mad, and somebody standing in front of me bringing in truth, Michael, you've been mad 87 different times with 42 different people. Your mad is about you. My clarity on the lie is a frequency pattern. The truth is a frequency pattern. And just like the light energy, they mix, and the mind goes into confusion. When one's in block to truth and truth shows up, people's stress go up. Remember, we're talking about John the Baptist. Stress goes up because those frequencies add together, and the result is what we call confusion, the same way as a red, blue, and a green light on the whiteboard make a confused mess, a muddy, confused mess. I don't have clarity on either red, blue, or green. And so the same process happens in the mind and creates confusion. And when one's in confusion, the way to clean up the mind, once again, we're back to forgiveness.
Amazing.
And Michael, what happens, just one more thought in there, what happens related to what you said a few minutes ago, when one actually engages in forgiveness, actual first century Aramaic forgiveness, Allah Yeshua, they won't forget what happened to them. But what occurs is, they go back and resolve the original source of the pain that they've projected into this moment. And the person who did whatever it is that, you know, when they say forgive, but I'll never forget, the person who does that, what occurs is they get the insight of appreciation of, wow, you've shown me a place in me that held this pain. I had no idea this pain was mine. I will remember with appreciation you always for facilitating that healing for me. Thank you. As opposed to, well, I'll always remember that terrible thing you did. Because the terrible thing that was done, the energetic pattern that created the stressed feelings is that internal projection. And so one tends to begin to appreciate the person who's shown them what it is that they need to forgive. And it becomes more of a treasured memory than the terrible memory that I'll never forget.
So the teaching that nothing happens to us by chance and everything is for our good.
That's it.
It's just what you've explained.
That's it, exactly. Life, you know, and I kind of say it in a tongue-in-cheek way in my workshops oftentimes. It's one of my favorites, and that is that the purpose of life is to kick us right square in the limitation. Life always has a plan for you, and it's always to show you your disease as long as there's one in there, which means that life is always beckoning you to forgive your diseases. It's always got the gift of, I could be forgiving and removing this disease rather than raging at somebody else and projecting in my brain's image of them and blaming them and having to get away or run away from them. And so it becomes one of appreciating. So life's purpose is always, as long as we hold any sort of disease or limitation within us, the purpose of life is to kick us in the limitation, to show us exactly what we're holding on to. And if we're putting that which is painful, life is resonating what's painful, into our brain's image of someone else, projecting it, applying forgiveness removes that projection and takes me back to direct relationship with my pain. And, you know, this is both the beauty and the trauma that inhibits people from engaging in forgiveness, not wanting to do it. The beauty is I get to experience my pain directly, which is not Dr. Feelgood, and I get to remove that pain. Profoundly powerful. The the reason why oftentimes people want to shy away and don't want to do that worksheet is they unconsciously know what it is that they're going to touch into, and they don't want to feel it, and they don't want to deal with it. They don't want to look at it. And so people, I've seen it. I've seen people walk away from this process, and I've seen it take them 10 years to come back and say, what was that you were saying? And want to engage it again. Because ultimately, in order to really truly heal, in order to have a totally and completely trauma-free structure, you've got to face, and in facing it, you're going to feel it, deal with it, and work through every trauma that's ever gone into your genes throughout your bloodline. And most people don't want to look that deep. Most people don't want to deal with that. They'd rather just drug, you know, just give me enough, a fifth of scotch. I don't want to feel that. I don't want to look at that. I don't want to work through that. Well, yeah, I want to work through it, but if it means I have to actually feel it directly myself, what happened to my great-great-great-great-grandfather, I have to actually feel it myself, forget it. I don't want to do it. And so they go around carrying the very energy that's literally causing their physiological deterioration and is continuously calling for someone in the world. Energetically, it's sending out a signal that through resonance calls somebody in to do it to me again.
So we're never going to get away from it.
That's right. You can't.
It's
geographic cure doesn't
come
work.
Around.
Doesn't matter where you go. Through, you know, because of this law of resonance, you know, these high energy waves that leave the mind when we think a thought, we're continuously calling for whatever it is that we need in order to heal. And it's kind of like, you know, like the creator or life says, I hate for you to be diseased, so I'm going to send you somebody through resonance. I've structured the world in a way that no matter where you go, you can go to Siberia. And that guy, you know, that speaks some, you know, long forgotten Siberian language, has never seen a person who speaks English before, is going to walk up to you and do exactly to you what that, you know, friend or enemy, what you call enemy or spouse, did to you that you didn't want to deal with and blame them for. They're going to walk up and bang, do exactly that thing, because life abhors death. And it's only when we hold disintegrative energy, which interestingly enough in Aramaic is called sin being an archery term, when you fire at the target and you miss the bullseye on the shooting range, an archery range, scorekeeper yells sin, you're off the mark. Whenever we hold an off-the-mark energy in us, that off-the-mark energy, because by its very nature, it's motion, and everything that's in motion sets up an energy wave. And so by holding a trauma, I'm continuously sending out a message. I like to call it the high energy wave or the creative psychic megaphone, and the message goes like this. I have this particular form of pain that I've been hiding from myself for generations, and I'm ready to heal it. Is there anybody that knows how to resonate it in me? Guess who's going to show up? The person knows exactly what to say, exactly how to hold their mouth to resonate that unresolved pain. The person in denial will put that pain into their brain's image of that person, their perception of that person. The person who understands forgiveness will go, oh, you just showed me some pain I didn't know was there. Thank you. We'll apply forgiveness, and as a result of that interaction, be freed of that pain. Yes, they'll have to feel it. They'll have to experience it. But it only has to be experienced for, if you're in willingness, it only has to be experienced for a fraction of a second. You know, the term I use, again, kind of tongue-in-cheek for willingness is it's cosmic grease. It's like when I'm in willingness and I'm willing to embrace this old energy, whatever it is. In fact, I ask life, send me somebody to show me this. And when they show it to me, I'm going to be willing to own it and work through it. Cosmic grease allows that experience to pass extremely quickly and be done with it. The person who is in resistance and doesn't want to deal with it says, get away from me, get away from me, get away. I don't want to feel it. I don't want to. And all the while, the life is bombarding them with energetic patterns that are showing it to them. Guess what they call the person who's in that kind of resistance? Guess what the Aramaic term for that person is? That person is trapped in Satan. In Aramaic, Satan is not some dude with a red suit, a tail, and a pitchfork that's out to get us. The word Satan means the resister, one who misleads. And you'll notice that someone who has a great capacity for pain, in other words, they hold a lot of unresolved traumatic energy, they're miserable and they're pointing at everybody in their world as the cause of their pain. And if you were to step up to the average person who lives that way and say, you know, Bill, I've been watching you for years and I've noticed that you've been through that pain 87 different times with 42 different people. Did it ever occur to you, Bill, that maybe that's your pain? What Bill is going to do is go directly into Satan. And here's what Satan is in Aramaic. No, Michael, that's not my pain, resistance. And now the mislead. This is Satan, resistor, one who misleads. So, no, Michael, that's not my pain. Did you watch how Harry did that terrible thing to me and caused all that pain? And they've got their whole story made up about how what's going on in them, once again, is somebody else's fault. In Aramaic, that's Satan. And most of the world lives today trapped in Satan. Nothing to do with the dude with the red suit, the tail, and the pitchfork that churchianity's been trying to terrify people with for centuries. Yeshua's teaching was designed to pull people out of terror, not to terrorize them. In fact, if you read through the whole of the New Testament, you hear, I forget just exactly how many times I went back and counted it. One time, I think it was 15, 16, or 17 different times, Yeshua says, fear not, fear not. Fear not, fear not, fear not, fear not, fear not. Get out of Satan. Get out of that resistor and misleading yourself with perception based in projecting internalized pain into your brain's image of other. Grow up, own your pain, forgive your pain, and now you're free of it. So that old adage that says, the coward dies 1,000 times, the brave only once. The person who's in continuous resistance, you know, after 50, 60, 70 years of that, they're in total misery. And everybody in their world, it's all their fault. That's living in Satan. The person who's big enough and understands what was being taught goes, oh, here's that person, Bill, resonating that pain in me again. Oh, there's Harry. There, look. Oh, instead of shutting down my breath, tightening my gut, and explaining to them what's wrong with them and living in this resistance, not wanting to feel the energy that's moving through me, the person who understands Yeshua was going to breathe. Ruka Dekutsch in Aramaic, feminine elemental force in us that undoes the effects of our errors and teaches us the truth. That's what the Holy Spirit is in Aramaic, and it's the breath. Go back into the Old Testament in the Aramaic where we're told that the Creator sent out his spirit. Doesn't say that. It says the Creator sent out its breath. Breath is that elemental force in us. And you'll notice that everybody's that's in denial, dissociation, and projection holds their breath most of the time. They restrict the flow of breath in them. Holding on. That's the resistor. That's Satan. It's much more imminent than what churchianity has led us to believe. The whole teaching, it just applies right where we live. And there's work to be done.
Lots. I have a thought here as we, I know we have to get ready to close, that the fear that's instilled in humanity, especially the one, I'm not quite sure if we go back hundreds of years and millennia, but definitely I see at the last 100 to 150 years, the greater fear that continually is instilled in humanity, does that cause individuals to fall away from the mark even more?
Oh, yeah. Fear just, well, there's a great acronym for fear, false evidence appearing real. When one's in fear, the mind makes up all sorts of projections. I mean, you think about the 280-pound, you know, muscle-bound guy who has a new baby coming and just totally, completely cherishes this new little one, but lives in fear, and fear is a filter that when it's active in the mind, causes the mind to produce perceptual constructs that will always show us something threatening about the object of our attention. Have you ever wondered how it is, why it is that this 280-pound muscle-bound guy literally shakes his own cherished baby to death? How does that happen? If fear is the active filter in the mind, this is why Yeshua said, fear not, but rather have rock and have love in your mind. If fear is the active filter, this guy looks at this 12-pound baby that's 3 months of age and is threatened, because that's the only quality of perception a mind in fear can generate. And now this helpless infant becomes the threat. And in that state of fear and threat, he literally shakes his baby to death. That's how it happens.
Michael, I thank you once again for the clarification. And each time I'm grasping more and more, my friend.
Yay. Well, I'm delighted to be having the conversations with you, because with all the years of work you've done, your questions are so poignant and so on track that it draws out an awesome conversation that then the whole community gets to play with. And so I'm sure that I'll get texts or phone calls from people to say, wow, that really was on the mark for me today. So I appreciate the fact that we're continuing this conversation. I hope that you're going to, as you ponder and think about it, keep making notes and writing down questions so that the next show we can have the next conversation about it. It's awesome to be able to interact on the level where, you know, you're interacting in the work you've been doing.
Just highly blessed to be a part of it, and it's just been a wonderful journey, and it's going to be great what's coming.
Yeah, I'm gonna email you a poster, one of the graphics from the workshop, Getting the Stress You Need. And it's a poster on how the filters work in the mind. And you know, with Yeshua, and we've only got about a minute left, so I'm going to just quickly review it. And maybe next show we can go over it step by step. And I'm sure Jeannie's probably already getting the link and putting it in the notes. But there, when they said to Yeshua, what's most important in the law? He said, have rachma. He didn't say love your neighbor, love God as yourself. He said, have rachma when you think of the creator and neighbor. And by so doing, you preserve yourself. So rachma is a filter over the frontal lobes of the brain. The other two filters are fear and hostility. They limit how intentions, frontal lobes of the brain, work. And then there are another set of matching filters. The one that's keyed to love is called kubba in Aramaic. And the other two filters are hostility and fear. And they limit the quality of perception available to the mind. So I'll send you that filter or that diagram. And I think you'll enjoy playing with it and looking at the refinements on it. And maybe we can make that tomorrow's show.
Okay, we'll do that. And thank you for sending for sending that. Thank you for your time.
All right. Lots of love. Appreciate you.
Staying here, brother. See you now. Appreciate
okay.
you all. Bye now.
All right. Everybody, thanks for joining us. Have the best year yet of your eternal life. It's an awesome gift to give the world. Blessings. Bye-bye.